This is a show about men, produced by two women, which I think is fitting. That's the way it should be here in 2018. Our intern, Zandra Ellen, who is wrapping up her illustrious time here, collaborated with senior producer Betsy Kaplan to look at how men feel now that they've been gently and not so gently corrected about some of their prior behavior in the midst of the Me Too movement and the Time's Up movement. How do men proceed? Because, you know, we're an orchestra. I mean, humanity is an orchestra. We're never all going to play the same instrument, and we're never going to all play it the same way. So how do men figure out how to play their particular instrument without upsetting the violin section? All right, that was a bad metaphor. You'll hear better stuff after the news. All right, so if you're listening to this show on August 16th, 2018, Aretha Franklin has just died. And it kind of, the song kind of fits something that it's a part of the conversation we're going to have. I'll tell you why in just a second. And if you're listening at some other time, I guess it's no less relevant if you're part of a Martian archaeological crew sifting through the rubbles of humankind. There's a lot of things happen on this day, is what I'm trying to say. So that song was actually initially, I believe, intended to be an Otis Redding song, and it was going to be about, and it was going to be a ballad, and it was, I think, really going to be a song about a very tired black man coming home at the end of the day and wanting some respect. And then, of course, Aretha just turned it into something else and immortalized it in a way that only she could. And it kind of gets us a little bit towards what we're going to talk about today. Let me quickly mention that this is the final, for now, effort on this show of our intern, Zandra Ellen, who's just been kind of amazing the entire summer. And Betsy Kaplan, our senior producer, has kind of mentored her on this one. And what they wanted to do a show about is how it is to be a man now that there's been – it's kind of like, you know, in dog training they use the term correction, right? You know, like a snap of the leash and the choke collar. So men have been corrected either with a swat to the snout or a little pull on the leash or sometimes a big yank on the leash depending on who the man, what man was and what he was doing as part of these movements known as Me Too and Time's Up. You know, some of the things that those movements were concerned about were very, very applicable to some men. And some of the things that those movements were concerned about were maybe applicable to all men. So the question is, how do we proceed from here? What have we learned? What kinds of lessons got incorporated? What kinds of lessons seem maybe not to fit every single size of human being? And so joining us now is someone who has interrogated these questions as few other people have. And of course, we're hometown proud because she's an alumna of this station, Anna Sale, reporter, host, and managing editor of WNYC's Death, Sex, and Money podcast. Manhood Now is a three-part multimedia episode of that particular brand, Death, Sex, and Money, created in collaboration with 538. This is a thing where Anna looked at a lot of these questions. So, Anna, I want to begin by just being, as only I can do, really old, and say and say that. So, I, as a newspaper reporter, I remember going to a men's consciousness raising meeting, and they were talking about, you know, the models of masculinity that had been foisted on them by their fathers and their sports coaches, and how those didn't really work, and how they needed to change and how their interactions with women were affected by changes that they want to go through. And all of this was happening in 1978. And in 1984, Barbara Ehrenreich wrote an essay in the New York Times Magazine about the new man. And she talked about a lot of these same questions. She talked about, well, it was one quote, "I see the change in the popular images that define masculinity. I see it in the men I know, mostly in their 30s, who are conscious of possessing a sensibility and even a way of life that is radically different from that of their fathers. These men have been, in a word, feminized. but without necessarily becoming more feminist. In fact, I do not think that those of us who are feminists either can or would want to take credit for that change. And then lastly, in 1990, Cheryl Lavin released this song.
Who liked to dress like Richard Simmons?
Sensitive new age guys.
Who are hard to tell from women?
Sensitive new age guys.
Upsetting. Who tapes 30-something on their VCRs? Who's got child on board stickers on their cars?
So, Anna, you know, these revolutions have been attempted in the past with varying amounts of success. What's going on now in your mind that's different? How does 2018 differ from other attempts to recast masculinity?
Well, I think as a show at Death, Sex, and Money, what we wanted to sort of bring out was, what are the conversations men are having with other men and with themselves about what a good man is in 2018? And I think what's different in 2018 than those examples from 40 years ago or 34 years ago or 28 years ago is now there's a sense of real consequences.
Yes.
And a sense of men looking back and rethinking moments, whether it was a romantic moment or a moment in the workplace, and thinking, huh, did I miss something that was happening? And I think that that's a really healthy reckoning for men to go through. But I think it does raise a lot of questions about, okay, if there are consequences for bad behavior, what does the model for a great man look like right now? Because I think we do have a lot of contradictions in our culture. We, of course, want men to be empathic and make room for women to speak and not to mansplain. But there's still a lot of pressure men feel, of course, to seem strong, to be seen as providers, to exert a sense of authority. And so we just wanted to hear how men on an individual level in their personal lives were piecing all this together.
Let's hear a little bit of how they did piece certain questions together. I think we've got a clip featuring Frederick and Freeman. This is about fathers encouraging sons to play football.
The thing that I was interested in or thought was important was that they not be isolated from their peers in the community. Now, football was the activity in our neighborhood where all their peers were, you know, they were engaged in that.
It's what everybody was doing.
If they hadn't been engaged in that, they would have been about the only one at home after school.
Yeah.
I mean, in the whole neighborhood.
The physical activities that I would have pursued probably would have isolated me from my community. There, I made requests to take gymnastics lessons. Eventually, gymnastics turned into wanting to take dance lessons.
Anna, tell me a little bit more about what you hear going on in that conversation and wherever else it sprawled out to.
Yeah, I love that exchange. That's Freeman and Frederick. Freeman is in his 80s. He grew up in Little Rock, Arkansas during segregation. His son Frederick also grew up in Little Rock, Arkansas and is about 30 years old, not under segregation, and is gay. And so what you hear there, I think, is a really interesting comparison of values. And I should say Freeman, once his son Frederick said, "I don't want to play football. It doesn't feel like me," he supported his son's choice to do martial arts instead. But for Freeman, suiting up and joining a football team was not just a way to participate in community, but it was a way to sort of become a man in the community. And then you hear Frederick sort of pushing back on that, saying, like, that didn't feel like it fit for me and who I was, and that's not me. And so just hearing that, I just loved hearing them talk about that, because often when you hear the trope about, you know, dad forcing son to play football, it's about like wanted him to show that he's tough. But for Freeman, he's talking about the real value of what it is to play on a football team, particularly in a Black community where joining together in on the football field is an important way of gathering as a community.
I think also for guys for a long time, And this comes up in the book written by Thomas Page McBee, who's going to be on at the end of the show. You know, guys sometimes thought, what can I do that just sort of answers the question about my masculinity so I don't ever have to talk about it again and I don't have to be tested about it? And so playing football is a pretty good example. You know, if you play football, I mean, in the case of his book, it's boxing. You know, but some sports writer says to a boxer, you're the only guys who don't ever have to prove anything because you're boxers. And I think one of the things, and I think also for a long time, a guy who didn't know anything about sports, didn't follow sports. It's actually in that Cheryl Lavin song. You know, there were other questions. Is he gay? Is he what's going on with him? He doesn't follow sports. And I'm wondering if you found that those very distinctive dichotomous markers are kind of fading a little bit, that they don't work that well, they don't resonate universally, and nothing has really taken their place.
That's exactly it. I think that a lot of the ideas about how to be a man in all caps are fading away. And in some ways, that's very liberating. Like for someone like Frederick, like he feels great that maybe a kid growing up in Little Rock today wouldn't have the expectation of having to be on a football team. But what that means is that there's less markers of how to understand who you are as a boy and becoming a man. And there is a sense of when you lose models, it's like, who am I and how am I to be a man? And I think that's a conversation that is missing. And that's what we were trying to get at with these episodes on the show, was to try to like lift up what happens when you lose models. And for me, where I came from, I am a woman, I should say. I'm a woman and I'm in my late 30s. And I grew up in a time for women where it wasn't just one thing to be a woman. I could think about the different ways I wanted to express my femininity and my womanhood. I could work full time. I could be a mother. I could figure out how to work all those things together. And with my sisters, with my women friends, that's been a constant conversation as part of my coming of age and figuring out what I wanted my adult life to look like. I think young men don't have that same kind of constant dialogue. I actually talked to a guy in the episode who just paused me when I asked him how he thought about like what a good man is. He was just like, do women talk about this? Men don't talk about this. It just was like, yeah, women talk about this. And I think it's important for men to talk about like the how it can be a little disorienting when you don't know exactly how you're supposed to be.
Yeah. And of course, the other part of that is some of these institutions are changing too. So, I mean, football is a great example. Suddenly, African-American football players are at a leading edge of social change movements. My own personal favorite football player, Aaron Rodgers, in the offseason met with the Dalai Lama. Right now, he's dating Danica Patrick, who's an extremely strong woman in her own right. I mean, all these—
I did not know that.
Yeah, these institutions, they change too. But yeah, there's still that question. How do you learn? How do you learn the right answers? So, Wolfie, this is going to be A3, but one of the people that you talked to was Alex. Alex, mm-hmm. like a lot of people, is trying to figure things out on the internet. In my opinion, the worst place to try to figure out important things. But let's hear how that's going for Alex.
Redpill fundamentally believes that every single man, no matter who he may be, can work out and can improve themselves and actually be successful with women. So, you know, Redpill's danger is that it gives good advice, and so people always end up seeing if their advice kind of works, and then falling into the wider ideology along with it.
Have you ever worried that you might fall into that?
No.
No. What do you get out of it?
I'm just curious about the way these people think. It's just fascinating, especially to see the way that they've evolved over the years. But a lot of it also comes from maybe not feeling quite as alone in the world, knowing that men out there are also struggling. Maybe they come to the wrong answer, but it's not just me who kind of feels a little bit adrift. That's probably more of what it is.
So he's talking about something called the red pill. This is a thread on Reddit that's, Anna, you could probably do a better job of saying what the red pill is like.
Yeah, well, I actually had not spent a lot of time on the red pill before Alex and I talked about it, so I did some deep diving. And it's a thread on Reddit that, on the one hand, has a lot of self-improvement advice from man to man, but it also has a real prominent misogynist thread in the way that it talks about women. There's a kind of ethos of, you know, this is how you can this is how you can trick women into wanting to sleep with you, and definitely like describes women as being totally emotional and capable of being manipulated easily. It's not a place where I particularly like hanging out. It's not my people. But what I found interesting was Alex. He's just out of college, and on the one hand, he told me, you know, I feel fine about who I am. I like who I am, but he's a virgin. He's trying to figure out how to be attractive to women. He's not quite sure how to get their attention. And the place where he's found tips that feel usable is a place like the red pill. So that to me suggests like, huh, what would it be like if we had healthier places for young men to go to talk about the confounding questions of dating and romance that don't have that thread of kind of anti-womanness, and it's a little concerning to me that those corners of the internet that are feeding those questions tend to have sort of an anti-woman bias.
You know, it's also interesting about the sort of where could you go to learn ideas about manhood, and the red pill sounds very similar to what Donald Trump was saying, you know, when he was trying to defend himself in the famous pussy grabbing tape, and he said it was locker room talk. And a lot of us who'd played a lot of sports, and I was still playing terrible basketball well into my 30s, but I've been in locker rooms a lot of my life. I never heard anybody talk like that, ever. Maybe I've been in the wrong locker rooms, but men didn't. In fact, if a guy talked about that like that about women in any locker room I ever was in, we would look at him like he was kind of something wrong with you. You're like a borderline rapist or something. And it is odd because I think there are these sort of models. Like locker room talk was such an all-purpose explainer for Trump in that moment. Except, I don't know, Anna, it doesn't really feel real to me. That's not how men have talked in the locker rooms I've been in.
Well, that's good to hear. I haven't spent a lot of time in men's locker rooms, so I didn't know for sure. I mean, I think that's something that I think is interesting right now in this moment is if you are thinking about yourself as someone who's not gonna be sort of put in a box and not gonna respond to Me Too and not gonna examine your behavior, and you sort of go on to this other extreme of like, this is, you know, I'm an all caps man, M-A-N, and I'm gonna behave this way because this is the way men behave, and paint men with this really broad brush. Like, there are certainly men who are like, no, that's not really how I see myself right now. And so again, that's why, like, sort of churning up this conversation about what is masculinity in 2018? What is a good man in 2018? What are some things about traditional manhood that are honorable characteristics that are worth holding up and saying, like, you know, it's great to show up for your family and to think of that as a major responsibility of yours. I think those are conversations that need to be had as well. But yeah, I think that, like, the idea that manhood exists on a spectrum of locker room talk, like Donald Trump claims happens, and then sensitive new age guy on the other side, like, there's a lot of in between those two extremes.
I want to talk about these in betweens, and I hope I'm not treading in a wrong place. I don't think I am. You and I a few years ago had a conversation. I'm like 72% sure we had it on the air, but you know, I might be wrong. But anyway, what had happened was, and I'm sure you remember this incident. You had needed a ride after being in the studio, like maybe on a Sunday or something, and Jonathan Schwartz gave you a ride in his car. In his car, I should say that. And so Jonathan Schwartz, who is one of the people who wound up being forced out of WNYC in the kind of midst of the Me Too movement, my recollection, Anna, was that he asked you some questions about like your love life and your attitudes towards romance and stuff like that. The kind of questions that these days in, you know, in training seminars for managers and office workers in general, we are told not to have those kinds of conversations. But my recollection, and maybe it's a little disorder, was you were kind of amused by it and kind of tickled that here's this, you know, quite a bit older man who's lived a life and lived a somewhat picaresque and colorful life, according to his own memoirs, is asking you questions about the state of your heart and your love and your romance. I don't know. How do you feel about that conversation now? Was it inappropriate, or do you still want to live in a world where Jonathan Schwartz can ask Anna Sale that question?
That's an interesting question. I will say at the time, and still, my recollection of that encounter was Jonathan Schwartz is this was a radio host at WNYC. He has since been let go, which is part of, in part of the Me Too era. My recollection of our encounter was, here is this guy who is an expert on, you know, the Songbook of America, American standards, which are all about romance. And so I found it charming that he, you know, the way that he has small talk is to ask people about romance in their lives. I did not feel like that particular conversation was in any way him creeping on me or trying to suggest that we should be romantic or to make me divulge inappropriate details about my love life. And so that conversation did not feel inappropriate to me. Whether I feel like it should continue, it should be an appropriate conversation to have in 2018. This is where it's hard. Like, it's hard to define what is, what has that creepy element and what doesn't. For me, as a woman reporter, as a woman who's worked in newsrooms, who has engaged with politicians as a reporter, and who, you know, the thing is, like, you know it when you feel it. You know when someone's creeping on you in a way that, when I felt signals like, oh, I better, like, not be alone with this person or, like, end this conversation because I don't like the kind of general tone. I don't think that means that questions about, like, I don't know, like, how's your family? Right. You know, like, who's your husband? Like, I think in certain contexts, like, those are fine. But I think that, like, I do think that I think it's been important for all of us, women and men, to think about how power works in the workplace. And in that context, I was a young woman compared to him. I was like a more lowly employee compared to him. And so the responsibility of people with power, men and women in workplaces, to make sure they're not, creating uncomfortable environments is paramount. And so I think more sensitivity about just like feeling out where those lines are and where those boundaries are is important. But again, it's not a black and white thing.
Exactly. I mean, the reason I was laughing was, as I was thinking about this, I started thinking about it in a Jonathan Schwartzian analogy, which is that, humankind is an orchestra, and the orchestra isn't 300 million people playing theremins at exactly the same pitch. You know, it's all kinds of different instruments that play in different tunes and tones. And so you don't want an orchestra with no bassoon, you know. Now, there's certain things you don't want in your – you don't want somebody playing a chainsaw, and that's like Harvey Weinstein, or maybe it's John Hockenberry, maybe it's whoever. You know, there are certain things you don't want in your orchestra. But you also – you don't want something that becomes merged together tonally to a point where it's toneless, you know, that somehow or other one of the things that – one of the nuances we're trying to navigate right now is, so what's a bassoon and what's a chainsaw? You know, what's something that's a little bit different from the violin that Anna plays but not so different that it can't be in the same orchestra room? And I think for guys, you know, conscientious guys, that may still be a complicated question. Am I making any sense at all? Say yes.
Yeah, yeah. And I would say the other thing to think about with the instruments in an orchestra is they were all made in different moments in time. Mm-hmm. So someone who has been working for 50 years for whom the workplace was a very different place when they thought they learned the rules of how to behave, like, it's very different if you are 25 and entering the workplace and straight out of seminars about gender politics in college and have very clear expectations about how you are to be treated and not treated. I think what I've really loved about the conversation about gender and the workplace that Me Too has brought about is it's allowed me and helped me learn to look back and say, huh, that was a moment like, I wonder why I felt like I needed to not speak up when that made me uncomfortable. I wonder why there's a moment when I was a young political reporter in West Virginia, my first radio job, when I was interviewing a powerful legislator, and straight into my microphone when I asked him a question about policy, he asked, are you married? And I said, aren't you? And he said, I'm whatever you want me to be, right into my microphone. I did not use that tape. And I'm like, hello, you used that tape, young Anna reporter. Like, why was it that I felt like I had to be embarrassed that he was saying that to me when it was completely inappropriate? That's what I think is interesting, is like women, all of us in the workplace, thinking about, like, why did we think that was okay?
I'm going to grab one quick call, and then we're going to go to a break, and then we'll have a little bit more time to talk to Anna and maybe hear some other things from her work, some other cuts from her work. But here's Andy. Andy, I'm kind of up against a break here, so the more succinct you can be, the better, not to put pressure on you. But go ahead.
Okay. Hi, Colin and Anna. So I grew up, I was born in 60, so in 78, I was 18 years old. Christine Lavin, I was the sensitive new age guy. Strong women in my family telling me, don't be like your dad. You know, my dad was a nice guy, but he grew up in the 50s, so he had, you know, he was just raised with those, you know, those traits. And so now, after having been married twice for 35 years, in total, what I've discovered is that for the same reason women often enjoy having gay male friends, they're non-threatening and they're not interested in sex, they cry at movies, all of those things, the sensitive new age guy, at least in my experience, turns out to be a great nesting partner, but there's not a lot of intimate sexual attraction to the sensitive new age guy.
So I think you're running your thumb down maybe the ultimate knife's edge for men. And so as we head into this break, Anna, he brings up a really great question. At least for men, men often feel like they've gotten that message that, yes, they would like to be able to hang around with a sensitive new age guy who cries at movies and stuff like that. But they also – there's another kind of, you know, a little bit more Stanley Kowalski-ish thing that they also maybe want to see, and they just can't get it in both places. And for the guy, it's like, well, which one do you want to be?
Yeah. I mean, I think that that's a really interesting tension, is like, you know, what is it when I say that I want to have a man in my life who is both can talk to me about feelings really deeply and also can make me feel totally taken care of and maybe seem a little bit like a cowboy. Like, I think that's a lot for one man to contain. And I think that that's a real, like, that's a real thing that like women have to be honest about. Straight women, if men are who they're looking for, and men themselves figure out like what feels comfortable. Who am I actually? You don't have to pretend to cry at movies if that's not who you are. But I think that's a different thing than learning how to listen deeply to women and to see women as having. You know, kind of being worthy of equal respect and equal, you know, just equality in those relationships. I think that that's a different thing.
Yeah. If you wait long enough, I mean, I'm in my 60s. I cry like during Flomax commercials now. So anyway, we're going to take a little break here. 860-275-7266 if you want to talk to us. And we'll be right back.
Child on board stickers on their cars. Oh. Whose last names are hyphenated?
Sensitive New Age guys.
Who love three men and a baby? A movie I hated.
All right, this is so much fun. I want to talk to Anna Sale every day. Can I have that happen? Probably not. Anna Sale is with us, reporter, host, and managing editor of WNYC's Death, Sex, and Money podcast. She did this fascinating project. They did this fascinating project, A Manhood Now, a three-part multimedia episode created in collaboration with 538, one of the things that got us thinking about this topic, too. From that podcast, just because we're pressed for time, I want to get just a little bit more on the air from that special. Let's hear the voice of Luke, and then we'll talk about him.
I'm finding my own big transition in my 70s because around sex, it is totally different. When I got into my certainly late 60s and now, my sex drive has diminished to a very low level. And then on top of that, a few years ago, I had to have surgery for prostate cancer. And I lost that sexual ability, fortunately, because I don't have the drive to do much about it, but it's gone. And so as a man, part of what defined me for so many years, and I'm sure defines most men, is simply not there.
Do you think it's changed the way you move through the world?
It has a bit. I realize that I'm a sexually impotent older man. And so I'm really aware of that, the sense of moving around, partly invisible because I'm an older guy, and partly being reminded that I'm also impotent.
You know, there's something obviously very wrenching about that, and not to sound glib, but there's a sort of live by the sword, die by the sword quality to it. If you get defined or you allow yourself to be defined in that one particular way and it's taken away, I mean, the abyss that opens at your feet, I guess, would be pretty huge. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. Hearing it even now, how do you react to it?
I just loved that conversation. For one, I learned a lot talking to this guy who we called Luke. That's not his real name. But he talked about his time in his 20s when he would walk into a room and he would scan it for, like, who was the woman that he wanted to try to sleep with. Like, he described his sex drive as this all-consuming energy. And looking back now with some embarrassment, realizing that the women who were in those rooms probably saw him scanning them up and down. And it helped me understand that's not a feeling I've ever had, where I have this sense of, like, just overpowering, that all I'm after is figuring out who I'm going to partner with when I walk into a room. And then to hear how he's gone through this transition now in his 70s, and claiming and saying out loud the word impotent, I was really actually moved by that. It's, of course, a clinical term, but it also is quite a loaded emotional term for a man to say, I'm impotent. And to hear how, for him, it has felt like he's free of this distraction, that he described, like, seeing the world now in ways that felt like he was seeing more colors as opposed to less. And I just thought that was really interesting, this connection between not only, like, age and learning how to move in the world, but also how that's very connected to hormones and biology.
Yeah, I guess I also feel as though, I getting ready for the show, I was thinking about, I don't know, like, you know, when I die, if women spoke at my funeral, you know, what would they say? And I would hope that they would say.
What did you think they would say? Yeah.
Well, I would hope that there would be a lot of women who, at least, you know, maybe just during the cocktail hour or something, would say, you know, he was really interested in seeing me do my best work, and he was really interested in maybe, you know, helping me get to someplace that I needed to get. And that's been truer and truer as I get older. You know, I think if I defined myself for a really long period in terms of my sexual aptitude or something like that, I feel bad for Luke that it took him that long, because it just seems to me that there's so many ways in which over the decades I've interacted with women, not just the one I just named, that to boil it all down to that and then to have to, you know, go through something that traumatic in order to see the other colors, it seems like a tragic story in a way.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's also a story about, like, how a very simple definition of manhood as, you know, conquest of women is very confining. And you're right. Like, think of all the deeper relationships he may have missed out on by not seeing women as more than potential sexual partners.
I want to do two things before we run out of time here. One of them is I want to discuss one more song. And so this is a song by Dar Williams. You may very well know this song, Anna. Uh-huh. I want to talk about two different chunks of it. So Wolfie's going to play the first chunk, kind of the opening chunk.
I won't forget when Peter Pan came to my house, took my hand. I said I was a boy, I'm glad he didn't check. I learned to fly, I learned to fight, I lived a whole life in one night. We saved each other's lives out on the pirate deck. And I remember that night when I'm leaving a late night with some friends, and I hear somebody tell me it's not safe, someone should help me. I need to find a nice man to walk me home. When I was a boy, I scared the pants off of my mom.
I'm getting verklempt because the song always makes me verklempt. But that song's called When I Was a Boy, and I'm guessing you probably know the song.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that's at the beginning. Dar Williams is talking in the song about how, first of all, she was, in a sense, at one point in her life, a boy. And she doesn't want to be babied in a way that you wouldn't baby a boy. She doesn't necessarily need to be walked home or something like that. Or at least it bothers her. It kicks some tripwire. Now, the part that just gets me and that I think people forget about this song is the completely amazing conclusion, which we're going to hear here.
And like the woods where I would creep, it's a secret I can keep. Except when I'm tired, except when I'm being caught off guard. I've had a lonesome, awful day. The conversation finds its way to catching fireflies out in the backyard. And so I tell the man I'm weak about the other life I live. And I say, now you're Top Gun. I have lost and you have won. And he says, oh, no, no, can't you see? When I was a girl, my mom and I, we always talked. And I picked flowers everywhere that I walked.
Okay, I cried the first time I heard that song and I'm crying now. Because, Anna, it is about sort of this thing that we as men lose. I mean, this part of it, you know, and that loss is profound. And I don't know who beats it, us out of it, but I think you heard a lot of stories that were kind of like that. Like, where did that part of me go?
Yeah. Where's that little boy? Yeah, it is. I mean, it's like, how do we figure out how to be our full selves in when there's lots of messages telling us we need to be one thing or the other? And I think particularly in this moment for men, some of those messages are crashing up right against each other. You know, it's something I think about a lot. I'm a parent of a 2-year-old right now, so I spend a lot of time on playgrounds, and I watch little boys and little girls, and I think about who they may become and what messages they're already receiving about how they are to be. And I think that, you know, generally this moment of saying, there's lots of ways to be a boy and to be a man is really wonderful. And I think it also takes support in conversation about, like, there is a lot of confusing messages. Like, yes, we're telling you can be all sorts of ways, but figuring out how to navigate that can feel quite isolating if you're doing it on your own.
All right. So I'm now officially a sensitive New Age guy. I cried on this show. Don't tell.
Very on brand. Yes.
Don't tell anybody, Anna. We'll cut it out. We'll cut it. Wait, what do you mean we're live? Nobody told me we were live. All right. We have to stop because we've got another guest to get to. But Anna Sale, so great to talk to you. You're so much fun and you're so smart. From WNYC's Death, Sex, and Money podcast. Let's take a break and then we'll come back.
And I remember that night when leaving LA.
Today's show was produced by Zandra Ellen, with help from Betsy Kaplan and me, Kion Wolf. The part of Bill Curry was played by a woman. On tomorrow's show, The Nose talks about the new movie, Black Klansman. And now, back to Colin.
So this next part of our show, I should tell you, is going to be done also in the format we call Radio for the Deaf. We have two fabulous interpreters of American Sign Language. They are here in studio with me. So as we're speaking, as my guest and I are speaking, will be available. And then in perpetuity, it will be available at the Colin McEnroe Show Facebook page in a Facebook Live format. So in other words, if you go to the Colin McEnroe Show Facebook page right now, you'll get to see the interpreters who are rendering this in American Sign Language. All right, so we're going to now talk to Thomas Page McBee. He's Vice's masculinity expert, former editor at Quartz, and the author of a memoir, Man Alive, which was named a best book of 2014 by NPR Books. And his new book, Amateur, A True Story About What Makes a Man, came out just this past Tuesday. And so first of all, Thomas Page McBee, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So, you know, this is a a book about discovering or exploring the question about what it's like to be a man, but in the context of boxing. And given the rest of your story, which I guess we'll get to, boxing seems like maybe a pretty extreme place to go and ask those questions. What drew you there?
Well, I mean, first of all, I think I'm a pretty extreme guy, so that might be the starting point. But for me, you know, I'm trans, and I transitioned when I was 30 years old. So I had lived an entire adult life prior to transitioning. And as I was sort of coming into myself physically, I felt amazing. But as I was coming into myself as in the world, I was noticing so many aspects of, like, how people expected me to behave or interacting with the world in this way that was just, it felt often distressing to me. And in part because I was raised by a feminist single mom and I was, you know, queer before I transitioned. And so I really was feeling like a dissonance often about, you know, how I was supposed to be versus how I really felt I was, which was ironic since I'd gone through so much trouble to transition in the first place. So the actual book came from my sort of breaking point moment, which was the summer of 2015. I had, for some reason, sort of 3 months in a row where every month a guy tried to fight me on the street. And I'd been, you know, on testosterone for 4 years. This was a new experience, but it was sort of, for me, the last straw amongst many things that were sort of disturbing me. And I decided that instead of just doing what, you know, the men around me were kind of advising me to do, which is sort of say, well, I'm not that kind of guy, and move on, or say, that's just how guys are, and move on. I decided I wanted to know the answer to why men want to fight in the first place. And so I pitched a story to Quartz about, you know, getting involved with this charity boxing club and training to fight. And that's what I did. And I ended up fighting in Madison Square Garden.
So there's a passage in the book. I think you're actually quoting a journalist talking to another boxer who's saying, and the journalist is saying, you know, boxers are the only ones who don't have to prove anything. You've already proved it. You're a fighter. You're a boxer. And that, you know, I've hung around boxers. I've written about boxing. I boxed for about 3 minutes, and that was plenty for me. Thank you. But you know, the problem with that, of course, is then masculinity gets equated with fighting and violence. If that's the way you prove yourself, and it's kind of a, you know, there's no questions asked afterwards if you can do that. I don't know. That seems so reductive. And I know it's something that you're asking questions about, too. What's the connection between violence and masculinity?
Yeah. And in the end, I mean, so that's where I started, because I personally also had been subject to male violence. And I was really aware of my own history of being abused at the hands of men. And then also I had a near-death experience, you know, where I almost was shot by a guy. And so once I transitioned and I suddenly became the man that women crossed, you know, the street to avoid on a dark night, you know, I realized that, like, this relationship, whatever it was, seemed to be such a clear part of the fabric of what being a man meant, at least in our culture. And I was, you know, that's what to me was the starting point of, like, really wanting to untangle what, why, and what that meant. And what I found, you know, through, I didn't just fight, I reported out this story in this book. And, you know, there isn't an actual biological connection between, for example, testosterone and aggression. I talked to a Stanford neurobiologist who explained to me that the actual connection is between testosterone and status seeking. And if you'll indulge me for a second, I can explain that there was these economic games they ran out of Stanford where the point of the game, to win the game, you had to cooperate. And the men with the highest testosterone levels actually were the most cooperative. But when men were told they were given a boost of testosterone, they actually became more aggressive, even though they weren't given a boost of testosterone. They were just told that. So that was a placebo effect. So these narratives about violence and masculinity are so deep into our culture and our sense of what being a man means, but there's actually, there isn't very much evidence that there's any actual reason beyond the stories we're telling ourselves.
Although what's in our heads and what's real become, you know, pretty interchangeable most of the time. And I think you found that too. Just maybe quickly just tell the Larissa story. I think that's a good example of it.
Yeah. So in my book, I tell the story of in the beginning of my training, I was paired with a woman boxer because we were all training to fight for the same charity match. And I was really bad, and she was really good, and she'd been training much longer than me, and she was this, you know, attorney and really, you know, aggressive, and she, you know, I kept being asked to spar with her, and in a boxing gym, just like anywhere else in life, you know, you're not supposed to hit a woman, And I found myself, you know, really kind of stressed, not just by, you know, I guess some valiant sense that I shouldn't hit a woman, but also by the optics of, you know, fighting a woman and what that said about me. And I was really, I was yet another place where I felt really disturbed. Like, why do I care what people think? You know, this woman could totally beat me, but I think that is what I cared about. And so that led me to wonder, you know, am I actually sexist? Is that even possible? And, you know, the answer was yes, of course. Like, I live in this culture. I've internalized sexism. And, you know, so much of the book is about these hard questions, that embarrassing questions, vulnerable questions, questions that I think men don't ask themselves because it's too hard. And I know you and Anna were talking earlier about the idea of a good man. And I think that's a big part of it. You know, when you want to be a good man, then that means there has to be a bad man. And it makes very little room for most people who are kind of in the middle in terms of like what we have internalized culturally to examine, like, well, in what ways am I sexist? You know, in what ways have I taken on aspects of masculinity that I don't actually agree to if I really think about? And that was one moment where realizing how much I didn't want to fight her made me realize that I was struggling with my own sexism. And in the end, we did end up sparring.
We're talking to Thomas Page McBee. The book also kind of deals with the question of passing, right? Ultimately, there were a lot of people in this fight world that pretty much all the people in this fight world whom you didn't tell about your trans status. Was that the plan going in, or was it just hard to get out of your get off your chest in certain fraught situations?
It was the plan going in because I've always been very open. I mean, I think, you know, when you transition late in life, and I had a career where I was pretty public about, you know, I had written books, and I figured if people Googled me, of course they would find out. But I kind of wanted to, in a sense, you know, and I want to be careful about how I say this because I'm a man and that's just the truth, but I wanted to go undercover in my being trans because I was interested to see how much that was a mediating factor in terms of how people treated me. And so I really wanted to kind of be a fresh slate guy on my own terms and see, you know, how people responded to me just as I was. And it was interesting because I wondered how much my lack of a boyhood might be informing the way I behaved, and especially in this like very homosocial environment. And I found instead that it was a really, you know, boxing surprised me. It was very intimate and very tender. And I think that cover of violence, to that quote you mentioned earlier about, you know, you don't have to prove yourself in that kind of environment, that cover of violence that that boxing brings allowed for a lot more tenderness and intimacy in the relationships among the men, including the men who I was training with, than I've ever seen in any other context.
You know, I don't know whether this is a spoiler. I'll try to make it not be a spoiler. So at the end of the fight, there's kind of a moment where you look over at your opponent. And in boxing, you really are trying to punch each other really hard, you know, for a sustained period of time. And you said something softened in you, I think, towards him. Do you remember that? Could you maybe just talk about that moment? We're kind of running out of time here, but I'd love to hear a little bit more about maybe what you learned about the relationship between him as one hand got lifted in the air and the other didn't.
Yeah, I think I just, in general, you know, I came into this book really, I'd been reporting on the masculinity crisis for a long time. I personally felt like I was experiencing my own masculinity crisis. I think we all are. I think it's a spiritual and environmental and cultural crisis. I don't think it's just an economic one. And, you know, in general, I found a lot of compassion for the men I was training with, to the point that you folks were making earlier around that lost self and that lost sense of empathy. And I think what, for me, that I got out of the fight was a reconnection with that part of myself. So for me, like the best thing that could have happened is what happened, which is that I saw this guy and I just felt compassion for him.
Well, I think you say in the book that you saw his relief spreading across his face, and something about that you realized maybe that you're essentially in the same trap anyway.
Yeah, indeed, and I think it meant more to him than it did to me in a way that I had gone through a long journey to try to understand what kind of person wants to hit another person in the face, and in the end, you know, I don't know if I understood him in any kind of deep way, but I felt this sense of deep just empathy. And I think so much of being male, even when you're socialized at this age, is about disconnecting from that empathy. And I really I felt like I needed to recover that. And I think, I hope the point of the book is that it's possible to recover it no matter when you've learned to lose it.
We're going to have to stop there. The book is Amateur, A True Story About What Makes a Man by Thomas Page McBee. This was a fun show, and I just want to say once again how proud I am of Zandra Ellen, who's been just such a great intern this summer. I expect her to come to my funeral and say something nice about me. Betsy Kaplan will probably come to my funeral and say that I took years off her life. But for a good cause, I think, anyway. But thanks to everybody else who helped out here and to our fabulous interpreters from our Radio for the Deaf episode, Mary Sue Owens and Cindy Ward. And we'll be back tomorrow with The Nose.